Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Dakhil Shamoh. He's a broadcaster in VOA's Kurdish service. Our topic on this edition of the program, domestic and foreign policy challenges for Turkey. Our guest, Soner Çaptay. He's director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the recently published book, The Rise of Turkey, the 21st Century's First Muslim Power. In his new book, The Rise of Turkey, Soner Çaptay writes that as a key NATO member, Turkey has always held an important position in global affairs, but lately Turkey has become even more prominent on the world stage as both an economic force and Muslim power. Internally, the government of Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been buffeted by crises and scandals at home. Nonetheless, the ruling AK Party won over 45% of the vote in recent local elections, setting the stage for Prime Minister Erdogan, whose rule is seen as increasingly authoritarian, to run for president in Turkey's first direct presidential elections. And in the wake of the so-called Arab Spring uprisings, Turkey was held up as a potential model for post-autocratic regimes. But as hopes for transitions to democracy were dashed amid the political upheaval in Egypt, the civil war in Syria, and now in Iraq, as the extremist group ISIS threatens to plunge that country into a sectarian war, how will Turkey's role as a regional power broker be perceived and affected? We'll ask our esteemed guest, Soner Çaptay. Soner Çaptay, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Dakhil Shamoh, from VOA's Kurdish service.
Thank you, Carol. I'm delighted to take part in your show.
Well, first, Soner Çaptay, to your book, The Rise of Turkey, I'd like you to talk about that, particularly in the wake of events over the last years, the post-Arab Spring uprisings, again in which Turkey was seen as a potential model for whether Libya, Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, etc., and how things have deteriorated since then in those countries. And now, in the wake of this extremist group, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, its advances in Iraq and the potential unraveling of Iraq.
Absolutely. Thank you, Carol. One of the arguments I'm making in my book, The Rise of Turkey, the main narrative of the book, in fact, is that the glass is half full and half empty when it comes to Turkey. It's half full because in the last decade, under the rule of Justice and Development Party, AKP party in Turkey, the country has been economically transformed. It has become into a middle-class society, majority country. And I think that's significant. Turkey went from being a country of mostly poor people to a country of mostly middle-income people. That's where the glass is half full. Where the glass is half empty is in the political sphere, not just at home, as you've highlighted, people taking issue with Prime Minister Erdogan's authoritarian style of governance, but also, and more importantly for today's conversation, in foreign policy. There's so much that Turkey has not successfully implemented to rise as a regional power. I think in this regard, the country maybe has overplayed its hand in Middle East politics. Only 3 or 4 years ago, the view of Turkey was that this was the leader country of the region. Turkey had influence in all of its neighbors from Iran, Iraq to Syria. Now it has zero influence in these neighboring countries. With the exception of the Kurds, it has really few allies in its neighborhood. It has not only led a war with no end against the Assad regime that has failed for regime change, but now also finds its interest in Iraq challenged by ISIS, which has taken hostage a number of Turkish diplomats and citizens at the Turkish consulate in Mosul. So Turkey's Middle East politics has been bookended by the developments on the ground.
With regard to what's going on in Iraq, we note that the United States is pressing Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for a more inclusive government, greater power-sharing arrangement with the Sunni communities, which are increasingly sort of turning toward ISIS because they feel that the government is not really protecting them. What does Turkey want? What are your thoughts with regard to what the government wants?
In fact, Turkey broke ranks with the Maliki government in Baghdad long before the United States took a negative or a less benign view of him. Around the time of the last Iraqi elections in 2010, when Maliki won, Turkey actually supported his opponent, Alavi, and his more secular and inclusive bloc. And that bloc did not end up forming the government. And so when Maliki formed the government, he was upset that Turkey had supported his opposition. And I think Turkish-Iraqi ties started to unravel soon after Maliki got empowered as Iraq's new prime minister. That relationship was in a downhill trajectory, and I think it was aided by the fact that at that time, Turkey had already started a policy of rapprochement with Iraqi Kurds, who had pivoted to Turkey earlier on to sell their oil as an outlet to the outside world for security, and also in alignment with Turkey's, I think, view of secular politics as opposed to more radical elements coming from the south. I think the Iraqi government saw Turkey's meddling in the affairs of the Kurds in the north as meddling in its own sovereignty and took issue with that. So Turkish-Iraqi relations were already on a downhill trajectory. But I think what has happened in the last year, the exclusion of the Sunni Arabs from the central government, has basically made the Iraqi government look like a Shiite force only in the northern part of that country. And I think that has added to the alienation of the Sunni Arab population, which is one reason why probably ISIS has been able to gain some grassroots support. It's not to say that it dominates the region by the will of the people. I think it still dominates it by the will of its sword and its violence. But it definitely has gained some traction in the north. And I think Turkey's relation with the central government of Iraq will not be repaired for a long time, given that the Kurds are now in the north increasingly trying to eject themselves out of Iraq, both financially and politically. And Turkey just seems to be happy with that. I think what we're seeing is a further strengthening of Turkish-Iraqi-Kurdish ties to the detriment of Turkish ties with the central government in Baghdad.
Some analysts have accused Turkey of providing or allowing groups like ISIS to cross the border from Turkey into Syria and from there into Iraq. Is there any basis for that?
I can't say that Turkey allowed ISIS to cross, but what I can say is that Turkey allowed other groups, including some radicals, to cross into Syria from the very early stages of that uprising in that country. Turkey's calculus in Syria when the uprising or the pro-democracy movement in that country started was the following. Assad will fall and good guys will take over. So if Assad is going to fall and good guys will take over, it doesn't hurt to let the bad guys go in and fight Assad, because when the good guys take over, they can clean up the bad guys. Mm-hmm. Well, Assad is not falling and good guys are not taken over. So Turkey's strategy is a misconceived one in the sense that Turkey is now realizing allowing anyone to go into Syria to fight Assad is not a good idea because these guys will stay there and they're going to form a long-term threat to Turkey. And now I think in the last year, there has already been military confrontation between Turkish government and radical elements in Syria, including groups belonging to ISIS. So Turkey is already unfriendly with ISIS on many terms. And what is really interesting, not just in Iraq, but also in Syria, the Kurds are appearing as a cordon sanitaire that protects Turkey from instability and radical al-Qaeda-related elements. Turkey has a very long border with Syria. That's 540 miles. A very large part of that border is actually protected by Kurdish enclaves, which are buffering between Turkey and ISIS to the south.
And that leads me to ask my Kurdish colleague to ask a question.
Okay, thank you, Carl. I will ask you a question about the most recent development, where there is an idea that the United States is prepared to engage with Iran in case of Iraq. Which area can the U.S. and Iran cooperate to solve the Iraqi problem?
Thank you. Great question. Look, if the idea is to get Iran engaged in Iraq so it will militarily assist the Iraqi government take over the north, I think that would be actually going against the idea of preventing sectarian warfare. Iranian influence in the north of that country, north of Syria, is going to be seen as playing into ISIS's main narrative that this is a Shiite-Sunni war, and inviting Iranians to establish order in Sunni-dominated north is going to be seen as inviting a Shiite element to the Sunni-dominated north. So I think it actually will accentuate the sectarian element of this conflict, and I don't think it will bring stability to Iraq.
Let's talk about role of Turkey and where Turkey stands in this situation. We've seen that the U.S. is ready to engage Iran. On the other side, we hear that the British are announcing that they will reopen their embassy in Tehran. In these developments, where do you see Turkey?
Turkey's sidelined to a large extent. It's not a kingmaker in Iraqi or Syrian politics. It does not have any influence in Baghdad or Damascus. In fact, if you look at Turkey's neighborhood, you know, you realize that following the demise of Turkish-Israeli ties, not only today Turkey has no ambassador in Israel, but it also has no ambassador in Damascus. Its ambassador in Cairo is not received well because of the fallout of Turkish-Egyptian ties. Turkey supported the government of Morsi, and when he was ousted, obviously, that was a big fallout in Turkish-Egyptian ties. I would add that Turkish-Israeli ties will probably normalize before Turkish-Egyptian ties, and that shows you how bad Turkish-Egyptian ties are. And now Turkey's consulate in Basra has been evacuated. Turkey's consulate in Mosul has been taken over by ISIS. So Turkey is fast losing diplomatic traction in this region. It has almost no allies left in its immediate neighborhood. And within the background of U.S.-Iran talks for a nuclear deal, if the U.S. were to ask for Iranian engagement in Iraq to pacify the unrest in the north, the Turks would see this as even closer U.S.-Iranian cooperation, and they'll be very confused, that they'll be feeling that they'll be left alone. I think Turkey might feel even more alone and isolated if an Iran-U.S. deal goes through and Iran is also invited to provide order and put down the ISIS movement in northern Iraq.
Is what's happening now in Mosul, in the Sunni regions, a beginning of a civil war in the region, not only in Iraq?
I think what we're seeing in Iraq is an insurgency. It's Sunni insurgency against the Maliki government. Obviously, this is similar but not the same as the insurgency in Syria. The insurgency in Syria is also a Sunni insurgency, but it's led by a majority of that country's population against a minority-backed regime. In Iraq, it's a minority insurgency against a majority. But nevertheless, these are insurgencies, and I think they're increasingly merging together in the sense that fighters from one country are crossing to the other. And we are seeing, let's say, in the Northern Fertile Crescent, from Lebanon to Iraq to Syria, the three countries are increasingly merging in their conflicts, where you have Lebanese Shia fighting for the Assad regime in Syria, and Iraqi Sunnis are fighting with the Sunni insurgents in Syria against the Ba'ath regime in Damascus. And it's not to say that this is all one big conflict. I think there's still the war in Syria, which is different than the situation in Iraq. But we are seeing two insurgencies in two different countries. And they're actually, the way the countries are next to each other and their ethnic communities are merging in terms of look at the conflict, I think we're increasingly moving in a trajectory where the growth of ISIS in Iraq is an Iraqi phenomena. But ISIS came to occupy Iraq from Syria. We should not forget that. Originally, of course, let's also not forget that ISIS went to Syria from Iraq. So ironically, it was exported from Iraq into Syria, and now it's coming back from Syria to Iraq to occupy Iraq.
We'll have more in a minute, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Soner Çaptay. He's director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank based here in Washington. Soner is also author of The Rise of Turkey, the 21st Century's First Muslim Power. And I'm Carol Castiel, along with Dahil Shamo, broadcaster in VOA's Kurdish service. And this is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Here's a shout-out to a loyal listener in the Dominican Republic, José Ramón de Jesús from Santo Domingo. Muchas gracias. If you want to hear your name on the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please send your feedback to pcusa@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Well, back to you, Soner Çaptay, to talk a little bit more about what's going on in Iraq. Now, as I said earlier, the United States and others are pressing for Prime Minister Maliki to engage in greater power sharing with the Sunni communities, but many say it's too late. Some of the Gulf states, and in particular Saudi Arabia, are saying that Maliki is not capable of compromise at this stage and that consensus government should be formed, notwithstanding that Iraq just had elections. How do you see Maliki's ability or not to make changes, fundamental changes in his governing style?
Well, a couple of irreversible things have happened in Iraq in the last year. One is that the insurgency, which came from Syria into Iraq, gradually moved its way across Anbar province and captured parts of the desert, and it has now moved into large cities. And it enjoys some recognition and, of course, through its violence, control over parts of the Sunni community. And so the question now is, can we split up the moderate Sunnis from the radical Sunnis who are supporting ISIS so that the Sunni community can go back to the political process and away from violence? And I think one way to do that would be offering them self-government, if not direct federal entities in the form of the Kurdish federal government inside Iraq. So I think we're going to see increasingly demands for Sunni autonomy inside Iraq. So Iraq, which is already a federation in the sense that it has a Kurdish entity, may now also end up having a Sunni entity. That's yet to be seen. But another development on the ground, which is probably not going to be reversible, is that the Kurds have just moved in and taken over Iraq's city of Kirkuk, which is an oil-rich city. For the last 10 years, every think tank I know in Washington has done studies on how to manage the Kirkuk issue and how to resolve it. That issue now has been resolved, of course, to the benefit of the Kurds who have taken it over. and it's not going back. I cannot see Kirkuk be going back to a central government rule. Not only has this city come into Kurdish rule, but its oil riches have also come into Kurdish rule. And what is really ironic is this is a multi-ethnic city of Arabs, Turkmens, and Kurds. If such an annexation of Kirkuk into Kurdish areas had happened, another time there would have been massive resistance from the Arabs and Turkmens to this happening. Regional countries such as Turkey would have objected to it. This time, everybody welcomed the Kurds with open arms because the choice was Kurds versus ISIS, and I think people took the Kurdish forces over ISIS knowing that this would mean no slaughter, no genocide, and no authoritarian and the austere rule of ISIS as well.
Well, just 1 second, Dakhila, I have to follow up very briefly with you. So what you're saying is that Turkey, which normally would have probably opposed this move because of fear that the Kurds were trying to get more autonomy, that this would send the wrong message to Turkey's own Kurdish population, that Turkey is not opposed to this current turn of events.
Turkey has not said a word and probably will not say a word because the choices between Kirkuk being taken over by ISIS or by the Kurds, and what that means, not just for the Turkmens, but for everybody in the city, in the scenario that it would have been taken over by ISIS, would have been slaughter. Whereas I think Kurdish takeover is political gain for the Kurds, but it's something everybody can live with. I also have to add that, of course, Turkey's perception of Kurdish politics in the region has shifted in the last few years. The argument that Turkey would have objected to a Kurdish takeover of Kirkuk by any means is really something you would have seen a few years ago. But even without the ISIS factor, Turkey's objections in the last few years have calmed down. That's because we have seen a significant Turkish-Kurdish rapprochement before the ISIS takeover of Mosul, which actually pushed Turks and Kurds even closer together. Now they're working even better together, and there's a long-term relationship that's going to emerge because of the common ISIS threat to both the Kurds in Iraq and Turkey's security. But beyond that, there is a Turkish-Kurdish partnership which was established by the end of the last decade when the Iraqi Kurds decided to pivot towards Turkey, seeing that this is their long-term outlet to the outside world. The Kurds may have a lot of oil, but they're landlocked, and they do need to reach the outside world, and Turkey seems to be the best bet among all of their neighbors. And Turkey reciprocated to this olive branch by starting strong commercial links so that Turkish companies entered northern Iraq. Iraqi Kurds started to benefit from cooperation with Turkey economically. And then political rapprochement followed soon after. And I think what we saw in Syria only built up the potential of Turkish-Kurdish rapprochement further, because as Syria decentralized, the Kurds in that country who started to establish autonomy also started to look to Turkey as a future partner. But the Iraqi Kurds are definitely engaged with the idea of keeping Turkey as their regional patron. I think this is the direction of events we're going to go through.
Of course, very interesting, because Turkey for many years, for decades, has had problems with its own Kurdish population. But we also note that there is a peace process between the most radical group, the PKK, and Turkey. And we'll talk about the status of that in just a moment. But first, a question from Dakhil.
The Kurds in Syria were the most effective fighters against ISIS. Do you think that the Kurds in Iraq also will be the most effective fighters against ISIS?
I agree. If you look at the opposition groups in Syria, and if you put them on a spectrum of which groups can coexist with which and which groups cannot, I would say the Kurds in Syria are at the opposite ends of the spectrum with ISIS. They can't coexist. Socially and politically, the messages and the societies that they want to create are exactly opposite. And I think that's one reason why Kurdish forces in Syria have been the only forces that were able to defeat ISIS, nobody else. And that's also driven by this antithetical position of the two groups. And I think in Iraq, too, we're going to see a similar situation where the Kurds have not fought actively ISIS yet. But if it comes to that, they will probably be strong opponents of that. And Turkey sees that. I think Turkey's Middle East policy is increasingly driven by the sense of the emergence of an ISIS-controlled Al-Qaeda land across its two borders with the Middle East, Iraq and Syria. So Turkey is saying, if I can't control the emergence of ISIS and if I can't destroy it, who can help me contain them? The Kurds obviously are physically a barrier between Turkey and ISIS to the south, and they also want to be friendly with Turkey. So it's a two-way relationship. The Kurds want Turkey's security as a regional big state, and I think Turkey wants their buffer state position between Turkish territories and ISIS-controlled lands to the south.
Soner, what prompted the recent shift in Turkish-Iranian relations? We note that the Iranian President Rouhani visited Turkey last week, a first official visit in over 18 years by an Iranian leader. Given their differences over Syria, they're backing different sides in the conflict. Turkey would like to see Assad go.
and tried to bring that about unsuccessfully recently. And of course, Iran is backing Bashar al-Assad to the hilt. So how do you reconcile
those differences? What we're seeing in Syria and Iraq is really stiff but cordial competition between Turkey and Iran. The two countries are fighting a proxy war in Syria. Turkey supports and arms the rebels. Iran supports and arms the government. In Iraq, they're in a political stalemate. Turkey supports the Kurds in the north. Iran supports the central government. And both the central government in Baghdad and Iran see Turkey's policy of meddling in the north as against their interests and something that undermines the Iraqi government's central authority. So Turkish-Iranian ties are very tense. Not as tense as Turkish-Iraqi ties and not as bad as Turkish-Syrian ties, but they're very tense. But I think it's almost like polite dinner conversation. They don't want to bring it up. They're still trying to act like they're good neighbors. They're still having these visits.
And trade agreements.
There are trade agreements that are going on. And I think part of that is because of the reality of Turkey. Turkey's economy is very large. And one of the issues I look at in my book, The Rise of Turkey, is this country is the largest economy of the Middle East. It's by far the largest economy of its neighborhood. It's going to surpass Spain in the coming years. And it's going to pass even Italy in the next decade, becoming the largest Mediterranean and Middle Eastern economy. It's $1.4 trillion in size. Incomes have tripled in the last decade. The Turks travel to Italy on vacations. They have high-speed rail lines. They have really good life. But they don't have any oil or gas or nuclear energy. And they need to import all of that. Turkey, ironically, imports 3/4 of its gas and oil from Iran and Russia. So it's entirely dependent on those two countries. And it can't really break with them in foreign policy arena. So although Ankara sees very clearly that the reason Turkey's Syria policy of regime change against the Assad government has failed because of Iran's protection of that regime and because of Russia's backing of that regime, it's not confronting Iran or Russia in the international sphere because it gets almost all of its gas and oil from these two countries. So Turkey's solution to this has been to diversify. And ironically, Turkey is now buying Kurdish oil and it also wants to buy Israeli gas, because this is how it thinks it will become less dependent on Iran and Russia, and so it can break away from the energy dependency.
The goal of ISIL, I prefer to say ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon, instead of Syria. So the goal of this Islamic militant group is to establish a caliphate, or khilafat, as they say it in Arabic, in Syria and Iraq. Having these facts, do you think that this group will try to keep the control of the areas that now they are controlling, which is the Sunni area, or they will try to have more lands, the Shia in the south and the Kurds in the north, or they will stay there?
Well, I think if you look at ISIS's stated goal, it claims a stake to all of Iraq and all of Syria. But realistically, I don't think that's what they're going to go after. I think their target area are the Sunni majority areas of Iraq and Syria. And if they run into Shiites and Christians in those areas, you know, unfortunately, that means ethnic cleansing. And not only that, but I think all of the, if they run into Sunnis that don't think like them, that also means ethnic cleansing. I think this group is highly ideological in the sense that if you don't agree with its ideology, it will only try to destroy groups that don't agree with it. So I think what it has captured so far is already the nucleus for a state or a small caliphate, in the sense that it already controls territory that's larger than the size of Portugal, with millions of people living in it, and that's quite sizable.
Soner, before we close, I wanted you to talk a bit about Turkey's internal situation. We don't have enough time to go over the many events that have happened over the past years, but obviously Turkey has had many challenges, many protests against the authoritarian, or what is perceived as more authoritarian rule by Prime Minister Erdogan. On the other hand, he wins elections. He seems to be popular with his conservative base in Anatolia. What is Turkey looking toward internally? Some people talk about a so-called post-Kemalist Turkey. How do you see it in the upcoming presidential elections?
I think, Carol, Erdogan wins elections primarily because he sells mortgages, vacations to Italy, and high-speed rail. He sells good life, better living standards, and higher incomes. And the Turks now live better off than they ever did, and they also live better off than any of their neighbors. So this is why he keeps winning, and I think he'll keep winning so long as the economy continues to hum and incomes continue to rise. He does have a strong opposition, though. Even with the economic growth and miracle that he has delivered, he only got about 45% of the vote in the nationwide polls on March 30th for local government. So to be elected as president in August, he needs 50%. He's not there yet. He needs to build his majority. And that's where the Kurds come in internally in Turkey. The missing part of the regional puzzle, Syrian Kurds, Iraqi Kurds, are the Turkish Kurds. Erdogan now has a peace process with Turkey's Kurdish community that includes granting them some cultural and political rights. And I think he's going to go forward with that primarily because it helps his presidential ambitions. with Kurdish support, he can be elected as Turkey's next president. Without Kurdish support, that's going to be very difficult. So that means until the August 30th elections in Turkey, you're going to see a charm offensive on the Kurdish side from Erdogan.
What happened to the peace process or the initiative, the AK Party initiative with the peace with Öcalan?
Talks are still going on. I think Kurds in Turkey want more concrete steps from Erdogan government. But I think what we're going to see is the following. I call it Kurdish rights through osmosis, in the sense that you won't see major constitutional legislation. That's not Erdogan's style. He's just going to grant these rights through administrative measures. And we have seen this happen already. Only in the last 2-3 years, Turkey has had Kurdish language universities, Kurdish language education in public schools, Kurdish language public TV funded with taxpayers' money, and that's all as a result of this peace process that Erdogan has launched.
One more last question. Turkey-EU relations, what about accession talks, Turkey accession to the European Union? Where do those stand?
Just shifting gears, one of the issues I look at in my book is how Turkey's economic rise has made Turkey less dependent on accession to the European Union, because if you ask the Turks why they wanted to get into Europe, the main answer was, first, they wanted to travel without visas to Paris. But the second answer was, they would become wealthier and more prosperous if they got into the EU. Turkey is already wealthy and prosperous. But I think politically, there's still a need, and that process will continue. But the Turks are no more anxious as they used to be to get into the EU at whatever cost. At the same time, as you realize that the French and Germans are not very crazy about Turkey's accession, it means it's a very long-term process. It's not going to happen tomorrow.
Conversely, one could say perhaps the EU would like to become a member of Turkey or because of its economic success. Soner Çaptay is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of The Rise of Turkey, the 21st Century's First Muslim Power. Soner, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. Joining me on the program was Dakhil Shamo, broadcaster in VOA's Kurdish service. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.